time on them, but I certainly don't want these issues to be a detriment to voting tomorrow. So we're trying to get a jump start. I think one of the issues was residency for the student regent position. I guess in discussions that I've had, I'm thinking we'll resolve that one quite quickly. And also, someone else has brought up the issue of employment at the university by a student regent who may also be nominated or advanced as an at-large, if that's an issue. So a little bit of a distinction there. So let's maybe tackle those two first.
All right, Mr. Chair, I guess for the record, I'll just introduce myself completely. I'm Matt Garrett from the House Research Department, and I'm here because I staff higher education issues for the House, and so I'm happy to answer questions and facilitate all of your work to the extent that I can.
Yeah. Your voice has a softness to it.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't necessarily have a full presentation to give to you, but I'm happy to answer questions about residency issues if you have them. The issue about residency for students, there are two provisions of statute that regulate sort of qualifications for regents. One, as you all know, is the requirement that at least one regent be a resident of each congressional district, so you have that requirement for eight of the regents. The second section of statute is a requirement that you have one student on the board. There is not in that section of statute a requirement that that student be a resident of the state. It refers to the student being representative of the state at large, which is sort of a different phrasing that I think implies that the person doesn't necessarily have to be a student. I did also look at the university charter and several other sources of sort of authority for the Board of Regents, and I didn't find any other additional qualifications for the student member. So I think it's up to you to decide. It may be the case that there's a strong custom and tradition of having a student representative be a Minnesota resident, but I don't know that it's a legal requirement.
Okay. Lois?
Tell me what the statute shows, if you would, please, about residency requirement for at-large regents. Does it speak to it at all? So is it possible for an at-large regent to not be a resident of the state of Minnesota?
So, Mr. Chair, there is no requirement in statute related to the at-large positions related to residency, and actually the statutes are silent about the at-large positions entirely. The only residency piece that exists in statute is for the congressional district offices.
Interesting.
I would also note, particularly for the student positions, that determining whether a student is a resident of the state or not is something that is sort of a judgment call on your part, although there are other areas of law where students are considered residents of the state. For example, in elections, a student who is attending the University of Minnesota is considered a resident of the state for purposes of voting here, even if they keep their parents' address in another state as their summer address or other sort of place where they live, they're still considered a resident for those purposes. So if you're considering whether one of your student applicants is a resident or not, that's something you might take into consideration.
Would you say that one more time? I'm sorry.
More loudly, if you can. You'll probably have to pick it up, the microphone, if you can.
Is it even on?
It is. That's close to the record. I don't know if it actually...
Yeah, I don't think it does either.
It actually goes up louder.
So when you're considering whether a student is a resident of the state or not, it's a judgment call, I think, on your part to decide whether the applicant is sufficiently a resident of the state, although there are other areas of the law where... a student who is attending the University of Minnesota is considered a resident of the state. For example, in the area of elections, a student who is attending the university, even if their parents live out of state and they go out of state during the summer or during other periods of the year, they can still vote in the state as a resident of Minnesota. So that's one sort of precedent that you could use in determining whether your student applicant resides here sufficiently for your purposes. But as I said, the residency requirement doesn't exist to start with, so it's more of a condition of whether you want to consider that or not.
Can I ask a kind of a follow-up to that? And I don't know if maybe you've already addressed this. The question we had yesterday is the university considers them a resident or not when they charge tuition. Is that bearing on what we do?
Right. So that is something, an additional factor you could consider is, you know, their residency status for tuition purposes. Again, it's not going to be binding on your decision-making because that procedure is different from the region selection process. It is just something that you could take into account in deciding whether or not this person sufficiently meets your criteria for being a resident of the state. But, for example, the residency status for tuition purposes doesn't affect your right to vote as a resident of the state. So they're kind of they all kind of operate independently, I would say.
Excuse me. Working lunch, yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I didn't hear completely what you said about the at-large position. I thought you said the at-large position did not require residency in the state. That's correct?
By statute.
Mr. Chair, there is no provision of statute that requires the at-large positions to be residents of the state. That's correct.
And we'll print up the copies of the statutes and hand those out to you later on this afternoon.
I'll take his word for it, but maybe is that something that we should take a look at and make a recommendation? Is it a positive thing or negative or...
I think that would
nice
be a
flexibility.
Something over the summer we would, or you know, probably not now, but that would be a.
I might notice we consider one of the requirements of our council, of course, is to submit to the legislature the criteria we use to choose those we recommended for election. And it might be something for our criteria committee to consider whether that's something to add to the listing.
Think about.
As also, Mr. Chair, that is something that you can consider yourselves as you're deciding who to recommend to the legislature. You can certainly take into account, you know, this person lives in some other state, and so we don't want to recommend them as a region because of that status. The issue is just there isn't a qualification requirement in statute for the regions to be a resident of the state. So it doesn't bind you all from using residency as a condition. It's just that they're eligible to serve on the regions whether or not they're a resident of the state.
So I'd like to move on if we can.
We're moving on to the question
of employment for the distinction between a student regent and a at-large or district appointment.
So, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding the question correctly, one of your student applicants is currently employed by the university?
Yes, that's a potential, that someone we recommend who is a student is a employee of the university.
Okay. So I think that issue is an issue that is going to have to be handled by the board itself and by the institution, because that's a Board of Regents policy that is part of their conflict of interest policy that a regent can't hold employment with the university. I don't know exactly how that gets fleshed out by, you know, what their standards are for making those determinations or what the procedures are for doing that. But it's not a requirement in statute. It's a Board of Regents policy, so I think it'll be resolved at that level.
If I could follow up on that, that is where I read it. I thought it might have been in the
statute.
It's not. It's in the Board of Regents policy, the new policy that they have has allowed for that.
As a result of Regents Figham,
yes,
they put in new policy, and one of our candidates who interviewed said he was adjunct, he would resign that adjunct to be a regent. That was the right answer given the Regents policies.
But there is an exemption for student.
Yes, student, absolutely for student.
So you would be looking for it. I asked that same question to Sally here about 6 weeks ago or a month ago. And I did have the answer in this pile here somewhere.
Okay.
We do have copies of the Code of Ethics Regents too will pass out to.
Paid and
Well, the point is there are 30-year adjuncts in the College of Design. Well, whether you're paid or unpaid, if you've been there 30 years on the faculty, mm-hmm, you're faculty. I mean, you know, so I think since our candidate volunteered that, we didn't ask him that, mm-hmm, I thought that was noble, correct, and respectful of the process. And politically wise.
Any more questions or comments regarding the employment issue? Okay. Oh, Dave.
Unless you're going to the next employment issue. Okay.
Well, not the next employment issue.
The question that we had is if we advance an individual for the student seat, can we also consider them as either an at-large or a 5th congressional district seat if they qualify? And if they're employed by the university, they would be would they be disqualified from being considered for a non-student seat?
Yes.
But you know,
that might be a university policy again.
I guess the condition is it could either be disqualified from serving on the board, or they could choose to no longer be employed by the university.
And that's what I think the answer would be. Most people, given the option of continuing to be a regent, if they're a sharp cookie, they can find a job somewhere else. I mean, you know what I'm saying, the reality is.
Diane, you're...
The third thing?
Yes, the third thing being the potential for an applicant to have some sort of criminal record. As far as what our ability is to use that information as part of our decision process, and also to gather information about that as well.
So, Mr. Chair, I think it's fine as long as you have an applicant that has volunteered this information. I don't think there's any problem with getting follow-up information. I think this is similar to if you had discovered this during a background check. You know, you might have, one of your reference checks, you might have followed up with it to get more information. So I don't think there's any legal prohibition on you following up with the applicant or following up with the reference or somebody to try to get more information about what the context of the of this legal history is. I'd be a little cautious if you discover that it's maybe a juvenile issue or something that might be expunged or have other sort of protections to the data as a result of the nature of the offense. I'd be careful about going too far. But as a preliminary matter, because he volunteered it, I don't think there's any reason why you can't give him a call and just have him explain further if you'd like.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On that point, I think the candidate that we're talking about was very wise and appropriate, and I appreciate him raising it. But I do think we have to drill further into that, because I think if we send him forward,
I agree,
somebody is going to ask, and if we can't, I mean, I don't know what the, I mean, obviously the nature of the offense would be relevant.
Right.
I mean, I can see a bar fight, you know, and versus something else, and I think we'd all look pretty silly if it were something else that we would have said, oh, if we'd known that. So who's the better of that individual? Paul? Can we get specifics about it? Because I think we really need to know that. I don't believe, from what I know now and the way you've done it, excuse me, it's disqualifying. But it could be, mm-hmm. and we should know.
Isn't that a matter of public record?
I've been trying to find it.
It was in Washington, D.C.
It was in Washington?
Washington, D.C.
or state?
D.C.
D.C., I believe.
I think we should just ask him. Yeah, I think he'll be totally forthcoming and not have to poke around on the Internet. But I do think we need to know that and have that in front of us, the specifics. That's my view.
Well, and I think the right thing to do is to go to him directly and give him an opportunity to explain it further.
And if that doesn't pan out, then we'll have to go to Plan B.
And Mr. Chair, the secondary question for you to consider then, once you get the information, is how would you like to use it? In what way is it going to affect your decision making about whether to recommend him or not? And I gave Sally has a copy of an existing statute that lays out the policy for state employment, which is not what you're obligated to follow, but can be a model for you to use if you'd like to sort of follow the spirit of how we handle these things for state employees. There's provisions in there for determining whether the conviction relates to the duties of the job that you're hiring, and then also whether the person has shown sufficient evidence of rehabilitation. So there are standards in the law for determining all those things, so you can take a look and see if that's sufficient for how you want to handle this situation.
That should give us what we need.
So Paul, I think in your questioning, if I could encourage you to not only find out the specifics of maybe what the offense was, but also maybe what rehabilitation involved. I think he did mention that there was no jail time involved.
Right.
Yep.
To see if there was any other anything else.
I thought I heard him say that he had to perform community service.
Yes.
As part of that.
I didn't hear that.
I didn't either.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
No jail time, but...
No jail time, but community service. Yes. Yeah.
Because that's what when he described, he mentors others to show kind of you can make a mistake, you get second chances and all that.
Any other questions for Matt?
Kind of as a follow-up, I mean, we have not traditionally done any type of background checks as part of this process. That's the only reason why, I mean, because someone came forward and disclosed this, that, you know, this issue has been brought forward to see something further. So maybe this is also something to consider as we think of other requirements or other things.
And currently our application does not contain a provision for doing background checks beyond the references that they provide to us.
Right.
So we need to determine whether or not that is an issue that we want to think about over the summer.
To that question, our application also doesn't have a direct question that asks them to answer.
Exactly.
Which would be, in my thought process, the easiest first approach to take rather than launching into a background check hullabaloo.
Would that be true for Greater Minnesota also?
You betcha.
Sally, Jim, are you going to help us remember
they all know his
comments?
Right. Exactly.
Thank you.
just call me, Mary, RFP. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I would like to move on to references if we could.
An operator knows.
I would like to put this. Well, I want to make sure
call the cafe.
We have Matt here. Is there anything else from a guidance perspective, statute perspective? Thank you very much, Matt. I hope you got
to eat. Pizza, man.
I've never testified in a committee that has pizza, right?
We're the fun group.
But you see, there's plenty left, and you're finished testifying, so you don't have to worry about your shirt anymore. So you can.
So I would like to move right into the next reference for Ryan Kennedy, and David had that as well, and I'm going to indulge in another piece of pizza while he's.
Yes, wait a minute. Pizza for me. Ryan Kennedy is the second of our student that we have who was seeking a dual degree, one at law school and one in public policy at the Humphrey Institute. I don't know anything about that program, but I'm assuming it is a multi-year program. The references, as they are indicated to you, includes an executive at the University of Minnesota that Ryan has worked with at MPIRG, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and Sierra Club. All work with Ryan over the past several years. And the summary of their reference is as follows, that Ryan is said to be always an active participant in committees that he's served with. He's serious. He's always well prepared. He's a very good communicator and well engaged. He does have an opinion. He brings that opinion before the group listening. But where he has chaired, he's chaired a number of committees and other parts of organizations he's worked with. He also has, at the same time, been willing to listen and consider the advocacy on the part of others. And some of these boards, the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, for instance, is a student organization. So you can imagine there's a lot of opinions that go around tables like that. And where he has chaired the MPIRG in the past, he has brought his own viewpoints, but also has been fairly articulate, I think, in listening to and helping others articulate their own. He is passionate, often apparent, which is a good thing. That's a part of the strengths. He comes with passion. He comes with conviction. It's also part of his weakness. He comes with passion and conviction. And the question has been raised by a couple of his references is, does he have the ability to sometimes to let go and move on or to go with the consensus? And with that in mind, I would say that others agree that while he does have an opinion and a strong sense of right or wrong, as chair, where he is one trying to reach a consensus, he is always very conscientious about making sure that other viewpoints are allowed to develop and that consensus can be reached. One of his greatest strengths, as well as his passion, is his belief in good governance and effective leadership. That he is interested in the process, on the way things are handled, that they're handled in a fair and above board manner. And he's interested in assuring the open access or an open process to decision making. With respect to the passion issue again, I'll just refer to that once more. He does have the capacity sometimes, apparently, to ruffle feathers as he becomes an advocate for his position. And that doesn't always mean the people on the board. It means the people that they're pressing against. And I'll mention that in a moment. At times, he does seem somewhat single-minded, but the references all indicated that he has matured a lot, and he continues to do so. One of those issues that he pressed forward pretty highly was the shared decision-making or shared governance at the University of Minnesota. And he was an advocate on behalf of the side that says that students should there should be more transparency and there should be more student involvement in decision making. He didn't prevail on the extent that he wanted to get to on that, and he lingered on that perhaps a little bit too long, which is why some people apparently in the shared governance mode might have been a bit ruffled by it, but at the same time, I think that people respected, according to these references, respected his effectiveness and his ability to put forward that, but at the same time go with the decision that was made in that case. And I do not know what the decision was. They weren't going to get into that with me. He does have some budgetary experience. That is, as board chair, for instance, at MPIRG, they do establish an annual budget. He is described as being always very intimately involved with that process, assisting in writing grant applications and in fundraising for both Emperor and the Sierra Club, by the way. And he understands nonprofit finance and the allocation of resources very well, according to the executive directors of those organizations. Organizationally, he has done some organizing with both the Minnesota Environmental Partnership as well as the Sierra Club. I'm putting together legislative briefings and gubernatorial forums where these organizations can present their viewpoints. And he has done that in advance of legislative sessions, but also done it on a basis of regionally, that is going around the state, organizing these forums. He was given great credit for developing questions for the people, for the candidates appearing in these forums. There are some candidate forums, other were legislative briefings. But preparing questions for these individuals as well as materials to advise them on what the organizations were doing, he gets great credit for that. What I had heard consistently from four of the references I did check is that he's a strong young leader, and everyone used the word impressive. End of report, Mr. Chair.
Ruffled feathers is a positive attribute, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. As long as they're not my feathers.
Good point, I guess.
Depends whose feathers.
Depends whose feathers. Yeah, that's what I should have said. Yeah.
I have Kelly
yes.
Smith.
Yes, go ahead.
So Kelly was here 2 years ago, and I think Pat had told me that you guys had put him forward as a candidate to the legislature. So with that in mind, I checked two of his references, and then I checked two other sources that he did not list as references to get a full background. And I tried to get more current references to maybe update what you guys had heard 2 years ago. So it was really interesting. I talked to four different people, and they almost all said the same thing about him word for word, which I found it was interesting in the consistency. And they were from various parts of his career, some on boards. One woman was a board member when he was in Red Wing. I talked to the treasurer of the city of Red Wing, and then also a city planner in Belplaine, where he is now the superintendent. They all said that he is an outstanding leader. He's a natural leader. People will follow him, that he is a great listener, that he is an out-of-the-box thinker, and that he is very practical. They said that He is first and foremost an educator. He's really interested in having the education in the state of Minnesota be the best it can be, which is why he is pursuing the regent position, and that he understands, well, kids are, their interests are most important, that he also gets that education as a business, and he's very practical about it. He's a math major, and he really gets to the numbers, and they all said that he was very good when it came to finances, and everybody that worked with him on a financial project felt that he did an excellent job. In fact, the city auditor and treasurer wanted to work with him. They said that he was fantastic to work with, and that they often went to him for advice. So he covers that side really well. I spoke with somebody that is on the governance board that he's on. He had been the president in the past, and it was the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. He's the past president right now. I talked to the current president, and they said that he was a strategic thinker. He put together a strategic plan that this governance board did not have, and he had to encourage 25 people to get that plan through, and because they weren't inclined to have this type of plan. And that he did it, and that they are now executing on it, and that it's been very successful. To a person, they all said that he would make a fantastic regent, and they didn't hesitate to recommend him at all. When I asked about his weaknesses, the only thing that people would say is that because he is a good listener, sometimes he appears to be too quiet, and that some people look at that as not a strength. But they felt that it was a strength for him if you really knew him, because what he does is he sits and listens, and then he'll ask well-reasoned questions, and that, and I heard this from every person. When Kelly talks in a meeting, everybody listens. So.
Thank you.
If I remember correctly, 2 years ago, we did not forward Kelly Smith to the legislature.
We did.
We forwarded four two years ago?
Well, we forwarded him.
He was up for the second district seat, and he was forwarded.
Yes.
And we forwarded four names.
Steve Spigum, Laura Broad, Kelly Smith for the second district.
Tom Devine was forwarded.
No, Tom was in the second round. Oh, yes, Tom was. Tom did go.
So we did forward four names.
Yes. But I'm not so sure that one of the previous ones you mentioned wasn't forwarded with the intention of being at large.
Correct.
I'm not sure what was forwarded for second versus at large.
That's correct.
He's going to go check.
We fixed Steve Sagan and Laura Broad in separate categories. Mm-hmm. And the legislature.
My recollection was we forwarded three names 2 years ago for the second congressional district, and Kelly Smith was not one of them. That's just my recollection.
No, Kelly Smith was, and I think we flipped Laura Broad into at large.
Let's call for pizza.
Amen. very good.
Yeah. We'll check it, but Paul, your point is.
Kathy Madsen was saying we forwarded him 2 years ago.
Accuracy.
And I had heard that from Pat, so.
We did.
I'll defer.
We did.
Any more questions regarding Kelly Smith? And moving on, Dan, would you lead us in the discussion about Chris Tested?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did the background check for Chris Tested. You should have in your packets four references, three that were yesterday and one that was an add-on today. Two of them were listed on the application form and two were sought separately. Numbers one and three are individuals that work at the University of Minnesota within the advocacy and government relations space. The number two is a supervisor that has been a supervisor of his in volunteer and part-time employment. And the fourth is the newest one. It's a letter that arrived just yesterday during this discussion from a fellow student who is currently within the Minnesota Student Association, which is the undergraduate student government. And then in addition, after discussion with Margaret today, I found one more piece of information I did not uncover in the background check that I need to put in, a reference check that I need to put in here. He was the winner of the University of Minnesota Alumni Association Advocate of the Year, is that right, in 2012, which my understanding from the expert is that this is a very, very significant honor, and it's only one person, correct? So I wanted to make sure it wasn't a parade of characters that all got that. The common theme through all of these has to do with his leadership in forming, founding, managing the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which my understanding, and forgive me if any of this is slightly structurally, my understanding is it's the lobbying arm of undergraduate student government. It includes representatives of all coordinate campuses. And both of the actually three of the references that understood this structure pointed out that one of the past frustrations and challenges in the past had been organizing the coordinate campuses with the Twin Cities campuses campus regarding advocacy efforts. And they praised Mr. Tastad's ability to bring in coordinate campuses in the structure of this of the MSLC. Additionally, that entity developed a legislative certification program where students that were interested in advocacy actually went through a level of training to figure out to learn how to be effective advocates and so forth. This was something that was singled out by a number of the references as being a very positive thing. The other common theme has to do with life experience. I remember from the first meeting of this group, there was some discussion about the student regent that we shouldn't expect so much from them in terms of life experience. And I want to say this process, through what we've gone through so far and in doing this reference check, leads me to believe that that's not necessarily the case. My understanding of Chris is that he's an individual that developed a passion at an extremely young age based on some health issues, a passion for the biosciences. He is a graduate of the University of Minnesota College of Biological Sciences with a Bachelor's of Science degree in biochemistry, currently a graduate student in stem cell biology and focused on regenerative medicine. And this is very much a personal passion of his, and that was developed and carried out also, but you'll see from one of the references, he's been an active volunteer at the Shriners Hospital for Children, and that's a multi-year process that is a strong and developed passion for. One person described this as kind of, in terms of tying in something Regent Cohen yesterday said about motivation, that the one thing we need to do in this council is to gauge motivation. Chris is not one of those people that the references get the impression that he has his whole political career planned out, like what year he's going to be running for president and so forth. Instead, he's very much focused on biosciences and advocacy. His role in advocacy comes from a passion for the university and these issues. So that I wanted to add just because we had a little bit of a discussion yesterday about motivation. The sense from the references is that this is not a stepping stone type position to other office or so to speak. The other things people have said, he's a good listener, strong communication skills, consensus builder. I did query, of course, on greatest weaknesses and so forth, and like a number of candidates we've had so far, I didn't find any that were well defined. So I think that is everything I've got in my notes. So
any questions? Questions for Dan?
Nicely done.
Thank you.
Sally?
Paul Taylor was right.
All right, Paul.
Paul Taylor was right.
You're right, Paul. He knows he was.
But if I might, Mr. Chair, we're getting old enough that when you think you remember something and people, you don't want to embarrass yourself. Mm-hmm. Paul took the chance. I had the same recollection because I remember specifically two things. I said he was a great candidate, but I just didn't think he could do two jobs, being a superintendent and being a regent.
Right. Mm.
And I had to make the call to him to tell him that.
Yes.
So I'm thinking, what did I miss? Did I call him and we really sent his name forward? So the truth is, he was a great candidate.
Oh, yes.
He is a great candidate. So. That was my concern then.
I do want to offer this disclaimer. All of you promised me that you are not going to ask me what I had for breakfast.
Yeah.
Or lunch.
Lunch is okay.
Oh, all right.
You spoke up, Paul. You took the chance. I said, oh, I'm not going to embarrass myself.
Well, this does bring up a repeat of maybe not exactly the same situation, but last cycle we forwarded someone who had been with us, I believe, the time before, and Al Anderson. And I don't know if Al was forwarded two times or just forwarded one time.
I think he would have been that.
I think I remember him, too, because I also made that call that he was forwarded. But I don't remember that it was a second time around. That doesn't strike me.
I believe he had been. I believe he had been before the council, and I don't think we had forwarded him
really?
The first time.
That's
And his interview the second time went much differently than it did.
May I ask, do people remember if Mr. Smith was present the day of the joint committee meeting? Because my indelibleness is in talking with him that day, which was why I was so certain that he had been forwarded, because I can distinctly remember the conversation.
And he may have been interviewed by the joint committee when they were filling Spingham's seat, mm-hmm. which is where
that's,
I was in my head too.
That's what was okay.
Along
okay.
with the banker from Elko Newmarket.
Yes. Okay. That because that's what I was recalling, just indelibly.
Next question.
Paul, Paul has always been perfect.
You got them more than
you. You got the magic pill.
Okay. Moving on. If there are no more questions regarding references, we've taken care of our procedural issues earlier than that. I think we're about ready to start interviews. Is that right?